We're talking about the first meeting of the consolidated plan in Pasadena.
All right. That was the first group meeting of users and potential users of consolidated mass spectrometers.
1944.
That's correct.
Okay.
Either in 44 or 45, there were two such
very
informal meetings. Then in late 45, there was the first conference called by them, the first group meeting that Consolidated put together that was set up as a full-blown technical conference.
Okay, now, you were still in Europe at the 44 and 45
That's
time
correct.
Frame. So you had not then been exposed to these until after you started with Standard Oil. And I guess in 47 or so, you were involved in these?
Well, I'm not sure when I went to my first conference. It might have been 48.
Okay.
I would guess that it was probably 48. And if I remember rightly, no, I'm not sure where that first conference was. I could find out. I have notes on all the conferences
sure.
I've ever attended.
Yeah. Just as a little bit of an aside while we're talking here, I'm kind of struck by this very much similarity of events driving things, which I got from Al Neer in our interview, and that is that the technologies of the war, the technologies of demanding or finding a source of rubber, the technologies that were needed to create atomic weapons, drove the development of analytical instrumentation because in order, basically, what I feel is that the way of doing this was known. I mean, the chemistry and the physics and et cetera of how one would go about creating these end products was known, but the difficulty was in measuring, knowing when you had gotten there. In other words, you had to measure to devise some way of measuring how well you were doing in your process. And here again we see that the need to measure this feedstock for the rubber industry and determine when you had what you needed to put in was an important problem that drove the technology of developing instrumentation for measuring these things in the same way in mass spectrometry was used as a technology for measuring enrichment in uranium
correct.
Plants. So it's a technology that was really driven to a very large extent, perhaps more than we even realize, by the needs of the war in terms of creating high-tech things, making your own rubber, synthetic rubber, and making atomic weapons. Without that driving force, it might still be a kind of a curiosity in physics, because up until really in the very early 40s, mass spectrometry was almost, at least as I perceive it, the purview of the physicist, and an occasional chemist might do something with it. But.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it, the Consolidated people were really the first people who were prepared to do the necessary engineering development to make a feasible instrument, that they could commercialize.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not arrive easily at the decision to invest what they had to put into that. It was a very chancy kind of thing. I think not only now when younger people who have come into the field over the last couple of decades may have heard the name Consolidated, but they don't really know anything about what the organization was or what it did. But even quite a bit earlier in the game, I suspect that not very many people have anything like an adequate appreciation of the enormous contribution that Consolidated made in order to make mass spectrometry a feasible, practical, usable experimental technique. They started with These instruments had been physicists' playthings, as you put it. And just a few chemists here and there had begun to look at, to use it, to make measurements on organic compounds.
Is it fair to say that most of these chemists were in industry?
Well, I'm trying to think. I've been going through my files and trying to run down these early beginnings recently in connection with a paper that I had agreed to try to prepare for JASMS, which right now I think I'm going to back out of, incidentally. But as near as I can tell, the first mass spectrum of any organic compound that was reported appeared in the literature in 1928 by a man in Germany named Conrad. I guess it would be pronounced Conrad, who worked for IG Farben Industry.
Okay, sure.
That's industry.
Do you recall what the spectrum was of?
Methane. Perfectly good compound to start with.
Oh,
couldn't
have
found a simpler one. He was working with a parabola mass spectrograph, so you couldn't do anything very quantitative with it. But qualitatively, he was the first guy around who collected a whole, you know, was able to detect a whole slew of ion beams and establish unequivocally their nominal masses, assign them, and was able to report that if you start with methane, pass it through an electric discharge, and then use electric and magnetic fields appropriately to separate them by mass, that you get ions with the composition CH4, CH3, CH2, CH, and C. In addition, you get C2 ions, and you get some C3 ions, maybe even a few C4 ions out of a mess like that. And this was a starting point. In 1930 and 31, there were a few more people who were beginning to publish. Conrad was publishing a little more work. Hoogness at the University of Chicago published one of those very early papers. Now, Hoogness was on the faculty at the university chemistry department when I was in school there. I don't remember whether I ever had a course from him or not. I certainly was not aware of anything that he had ever done in mass spectrometry. I wasn't aware of mass spectrometry at the time that I was.
How would you spell his name?
H-O-G-N-E-S-S.
Okay, it's kind of like a, well,
I think his first name was a good Scandinavian name, something like Thorfinn. I'm not sure if that was right, but that's pretty close, I think.
Yeah. So, but now he would be in the academic environment. Then.
Yes, yes. So he was academic. But, and then, of course, about 1935 or 36, in his work, well, let me back up and say that it was either, there was another team's, Stewart and Olson. If you interrupt it for a moment, I think I can tell you where they were located.
Sure. Just stop this for...
In 1928, was by T.R. Hoogness and H.M. Kvalnes, K-V-A-L-N-E-S. That was 1928, published in a Physical Review. Then Conrad came along, and he published in 1930, he published a paper dealing with methane, and along with a collaborator, a man named Eisenhut, he extended that from methane to include ethane, ethylene, and acetylene. In 1934, Conrad published a more extensive piece of work in which he pinned down a set of rules that were obeyed by these ions.
These were obviously positive, I guess essentially positive ion spectra. They were positive ions.
Yes, yes. And backing up, in 1931, Stewart and Olson published a paper in which they reported spectra of propane and butane, and where they also arrived at the conclusion that the ionizing electrons decompose the hydrocarbons on impact.
Mm-hmm. These were these people in industry or academia, Stewart and Olson?
Were they what?
Were they in industry or in academia?
Well, let's see. I had the Stewart and Olson stuff elsewhere. Hang on a minute.
Okay.
I find that when Hovness and Caldas published that work, that was at the University of California. Hovness must have come to the University of Chicago later.
Mm-hmm.
And the work by Stewart and Olson lists as the only address here, Berkeley, California. So I would guess that they were at the university also. So there were academic people in the game very early.
Okay.
But not very many.
Yeah.
Not very many.
Yeah. And their interest was more from the organic chemistry side as opposed to the physics side.
Well, it was more than that. These various people were first just trying to get some qualitative notion of what happened in a discharge and then later under electron impact. They were really struggling with instrument design and construction. They had some systems that were terribly complicated by virtue of the pressures generally being a good deal higher than what we ultimately learned were necessary for good reproducible work, so that there was a lot of chemical ionization that was going on right then, except that's not the term that was being used for it.
It's one of those technologies that was happening, but nobody knew about it until about 30 or 40 years later.
That's right. Now, in the mid-30s, NIR measured the mass spectrum of benzene, as I think you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he ever published that.
That's my understanding. He showed it to me from his original notes, and I've got a Xerox copy of the thing plotted out by hand that he made in the 30s. But I think he also admitted to the fact that he just did it as a curiosity, and he didn't really do anything more with it.
Although back here, there was a paper published in 1934. In Transactions of the Faraday Society by Conrad, entitled Decomposition of Hexane, Cyclohexane, and Benzene in the Positive Array Tube.
Mm.
He beat.
He beat out, huh?
He beat here on that, yes. Yeah. And then in about 36 or thereabouts, Dwight Taylor was working at Caltech, doing his graduate work on attempting to develop a mass spectrometer that the folks there thought might possibly have some actual application for in petroleum refineries.
Mm-hmm.
They gave up on that. But he's published at least one paper, and I have that somewhere in my files, although it's not right in front of me at the moment. And when the people that consolidated concluded that decided to take a stab at trying to develop a mass spectrometer, they learned of this work at Caltech,
mm-hmm.
and they went back and talked to the people there, and in fact ended up borrowing the equipment, the instrumentation that had been built there and disassembled to start with. And Dwight Taylor showed up one day in their office looking for a job. They hired him.
Oh, my.
So that he played a part. I don't know how long he was there or how much of a part he played, but he was involved in the very early work there at Consolidated. Also, there was there was an academic contribution all the way through, but it was small. Mm-hmm. It was very small, and the great bulk of what developed for many years in mass spectrometry came out of industry, and predominantly the petroleum industry. Mm-hmm. I remember that in the late 50s and early 60s, when for the first time a lot of academic people were moving into the field, many of my friends and cohorts working for petroleum laboratories and for chemical companies were quite upset with our annual mass spectrometer conferences. They said that these conferences are becoming more and more theoretical, and they don't see how they're going to be able to continue to persuade their management that there's anything useful mm-hmm. that they're going to learn there. Mm-hmm. And I started at that time to find myself on kind of a fence with one foot in the theoretical or
fundamental
end of things and one foot in the applied kind of thing. I just have a lot of company trying to build bridges and persuade these guys that they're not going to be able to afford to ignore what's going on mm-hmm. at the other end of things.
Yeah.
And if they don't find enough analytical content to keep them satisfied, I urge them to just prepare more papers yourselves.
Yeah.
Because the program committee will schedule virtually anything that anybody in the field offers. Mm-hmm. So if you want a symposium or just individual papers on analytical problems, prepare them and submit them. Mm-hmm. They'll get on the program and you'll have more analytical.
This almost comes back to the issue that we started this discussion on with Frank Field and you know, the difference in opinions about the utility of being involved in real problems and just doing unconnected or distant basic research. So I guess it's, as I mentioned earlier, it just appears to be a dichotomy that's there, and there are a few people that like to bridge that area, but it seems like many people would prefer to be in one or the other and not be in the middle.
Yeah.
Whereas the middle is kind of the most interesting place, I would think, or can be quite challenging.
Oh, yes.
So we are up into the area of about the late 40s. You have started with Standard Oil of Ohio?
Is it? Indiana.
Indiana, Standard Oil of Indiana. And you found a home with a mass spectrometer, finally. It is an instrument that you feel familiar or good with. It makes use of a lot of your background. What did you do when you got on board there and started to get into it? What exactly kinds of things were you? I mean, we know you the applications that were being performed, but what did you start out in?
First, my group leader, as I mentioned before, was E.B. Tucker. Mm-hmm. The senior person in the team working on the mass spectrometer was Henry Grubb.
That's G-R-U-B?
B, two B's.
Two B's.
Henry was a product of Purdue University. He'd worked for the company about 10 years then. He and Tucker had worked together in the grease plant, I think, until somebody decided the company needs an analytical group. Mm-hmm. And when Tuck was tapped for that, he insisted on taking Grubb along with him. Henry had done his undergraduate work in physics and his graduate work in physical chemistry. And he was a very, very sharp guy mm-hmm. with a great deal of insight and understanding of technical matters and of people, both. Quite apart from anything technical, he was he had read widely, extensively, in biblical history.
Oh, my.
And he loved to get into discussions of things he found there. I still recall his describing some human society, and I don't know where or when it existed, in which the established pattern was that the guy who occupied the seat way at the top of the heap, the king or emperor, whatever he was called, had enormous power, but when he ascended to that seat, he had already agreed that he would be allowed to maintain that position of power for 1 year, and at the end of that time he would be beheaded. And Henry felt that our politics in this country might be improved considerably if we were to adopt a practice like that.
Yes, that would that's an interesting way to go.
I recall that not only Tucker, but also Henry were very generous and very kind and very understanding to in helping me to get started. Mm-hmm. As I put it to them, that I felt I had a decent background in both chemistry and electronics, I was well aware that both were rusty, and I was going to need work time. Henry turned me loose there, introduced me to the equipment, introduced me to the manuals, to the other people, and he told me not to feel under any pressure, just take all the time I want. And he said, you know, by the end of the year, we expect that you'll be functioning pretty smoothly, but don't feel necessary to push yourself or to rush things before then. And that really was very helpful to me in getting started.
Yeah, it sounds like an ideal situation. Particularly for, you know, like you say, someone who has the background but hasn't really had a chance, it's rusty, haven't used it, it's there. So then you just essentially, did you just run samples or just, run the machine?
I ran samples. From time to time, when work was being done on some of the circuitry, if I indicated I'd like to have a hand in it, I was welcomed.
Was this in repair?
Well, it was more than that. First, the instrument was still really pretty primitive. For example, if you sat down to run a sample, a gas sample, and that was what most of the work was on the machine, mm-hmm. you figure that running it would take maybe 15, 20 minutes. During that time, you kept your hand on the potentiometer that controlled the filament current, and you kept looking at the meter that measured the ionizing current, and you kept jiggling the filament current in order to try to hold the ionizing current as steady as you could. Now, actually, Henry and Red Schmalk had built a feedback control circuit about a year earlier that would do that automatically, but at the time I started to work there, that feedback circuit was on the blink, was being rebuilt, and I think perhaps redesigned, so that this is the way in which we had to operate. Now, there were a lot of instrument development that was still needed at that point, and as I think you may be aware, as I've stated elsewhere, when that instrument was sold to Indiana Standard in 1943, the sales contract included a provision that any instrumental developments or improvements that might occur there within the company's laboratories would be made available without any cost, without royalty, to Consolidated. Mm-hmm. So that there were a good many instrumental developments that took place there in our laboratory and that took place in users' laboratories and lots of other places, mm-hmm. that were fed back to Consolidated, and many of them were incorporated into the design of subsequent instruments.
Speaking of the sales contract, do you have any idea what that instrument cost?
That first instrument was $19,500 plus some additional cost. Well, I'm not sure. The first few were sold for $19,500 plus additional charges for training.
Sure.
And I think subsequently the additional charges were made a fixed amount of $2,000. And they operated at that level for some period of time.
There's the issue. Consolidated had a number of names. There was Consolidated Engineering and Consolidated Electrodynamics.
Yes. I don't remember just when the name was changed, but they kept the same initials of course, CEC.
Yeah.
But that's right. Started out, I believe, as Consolidated Electronics.
Electrodynamics.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious because I know I'm familiar with that name problem, but I don't have anybody who knows exactly when was what. I'm not sure that really matters, but basically we know we're talking about CEC
That's correct.
So then you were encouraged to use the machine. It still had the oscillographic recording.
That's all we had. We took the photographic record out in a black sleeve, took it into a dark room, and processed it. And then at first we recorded both the trace and the scale. There was a device in the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Which was referred to as an oscillograph,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that put a scale on the paper. It was optional. You could make it as heavy or as light as you liked. And only later did somebody establish, and we confirmed for ourselves, that if we follow the processing, the photographic processing and drying schedule very carefully, that it would dry, the paper would dry to the same size every time, so that you didn't have to have a scale recorded on the paper. You could use a rule slided along to measure the peak heights.
Okay.
But it took a while before we realized that.
So you probably used a lot of oscillographic recording paper.
That's correct.
In this business. And
that was haloid.
Yeah.
And the first couple of batches or so that we used of Eastman paper, when they tried to break into this field, were really not very satisfactory. I don't remember for sure what the problem was. I seem to recall that the paper was thinner than the haloid paper, and it dried very brittle, so that it tended to crack and break. And we stuck with haloid for years. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, that problem was corrected, but it took a long time.
In running the instrument, you're really kind of running a little bit blind. You're setting parameters and looking at needles, but you aren't actually seeing an ion current in real time, is that correct? In other words, is there any monitor on the instrument that would tell you that you were actually getting ions at the detector? Many modern instruments have the nice feature that you can see your a small portion of the spectrum, or a couple of peaks, and you can adjust the ion source parameters to optimize the tuning and so on. But as I recall, in this instrument, you basically kind of set it up and...
You know, I don't remember clearly, but I think that there was a meter on one of the panels that responded to ion current. so that when we were focused on a beam, the needle would be would deflect. So that and that, that we would have had to have something. And I think that I seem to recall that.
Did you ever run into a situation where you thought you had a spectrum, and when it developed, you found out you didn't have anything? Or I mean,
not that I recall.
Okay. So it was a pretty dependable operation once you got into the hang.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I could add here that even that over the years, even while a great many of these consolidated instruments were still in widespread use, a good many people tended to be critical of the procedures that Consolidated had set down and established that became more or less standard throughout the field, and felt that they just didn't measure up. That does not jibe with my perception. As far as I can see, the Consolidated people did extraordinarily well in selecting good operating conditions to get highly reproducible quantitative results. I have a vague kind of recollection of having heard or read somewhere that they originally started by recommending using 50-volt electrons, but by the time I got started, that had been changed to 70. And I think 70 is still pretty generally in use in all kinds of instruments. And the point was, of course, that they wanted to find an electron energy such that if it varied a few volts one way or another, it wasn't going to have any measurable effect on the ion beams. And they did very well. They did a remarkable job of putting together apparatus that could be well evacuated, and of selecting conditions that were essentially free of any bimolecular processes, that minimized any effect of potential well in the source. Despite all the other means of ionization that have come into service, I suspect that electron impact even today continues to be probably the most satisfactory general purpose one for a vast, vast assortment of problems. So that they did very well by us, and I feel that really all of us who have been part of this game have a huge debt to the people at Consolidated.
Because they did their homework and they did it right.
That's correct.
And what do you have any idea what size their operation was in terms of people at that time? Were they talking about a relatively small group of people? I would assume maybe 50 or.
Well, I don't really know. It was a small outfit, certainly. Now, Consolidated was organized as a corporation in 1937 with Herbert Hoover Jr. as the president and Harold Washburn as vice president, director of research. During the first several years, at least, I don't think I was ever conscious of more than maybe a dozen technical people in that organization. Now, my contacts were primarily with people in their research, but then they overlapped research into sales, and I'm certain that we must have had contact with some of the people from their engineering department. I think you know that my closest contact, who was a very, very valuable source of information to me when I was putting together the reminiscences paper a few years ago was Harold Wiley, mm-hmm. who died a year or two ago, mm-hmm. incidentally. I believe that Charlie Judson finally, through me, did get together with Harold and did go through his files of historical material mm-hmm. while he was still alive on behalf of the history subcommittee mm-hmm. of ASMS. But he was he certainly played a key role there. Cliff Berry played an important role in a design both of the mass spectrometers and of the early computing equipment. Mm-hmm. And that early computing equipment really was early. The analog computer for calculating Gauss analyses mm-hmm. was introduced at the third consolidated group meeting in late 1945. Mm-hmm. And that was the first of those meetings that was set up formally as a in the format of a technical conference, so that they started putting together computing equipment really very early in the game. Mm-hmm. I was quite annoyed when I was in the course of my completing that reminiscences paper for publication. I added two aspects of the work that had not been in the original presentation at San Antonio. One of them had to do with computing equipment, mm-hmm. and the other had to do with type analysis and qualitative analysis. Now, at San Antonio, the computing end of things was taken care of pretty much by a paper by Klaus Beeman, mm-hmm. but he made no attempt to cover anything prior to his entry into the field, which came in late 50s.
Yeah.
Now, when I did start hunting up some of the earlier computing work, one of my leads led me to a text, a history of electronic computing, in which the author describes some work that Cliff Berry did when he was a graduate student at Iowa State working for Atanasoff.
Okay, is that, how do you spell that?
Atanasoff.
Okay.
Now, the man, you know, who is generally credited with having built the first fully electronic computer is John Mauchly, M-A-U-C-H-L-Y. And when Mauchly was at a fairly early stage of his thinking in these terms, he heard a paper at a conference by Atanasoff and wangled an invitation to visit Atanasoff's laboratory at Iowa. And there he was given a demonstration of what they call the ABC computer, the Atanasoff-Berry computer. Berry was the graduate student working for Atanasoff who had done most of the actual shop and laboratory work putting the thing together. Yeah. As I understand it, their computer was only partly electronic, was largely electrical. And in the in this published history of computing, mm-hmm. The author acknowledges the work that was done by Berry there at Iowa State, and says that when he left Iowa State, he went on to a rather undistinguished career. When I found that, I was shocked. And I wrote him a letter and pointed out that for mass spectrometrists, for a lot of years, the name Cliff Berry was one that we revered highly. He made enormous contributions both to developments in mass spectrometry and to computing equipment for use with mass spectrometry. I felt that the author owed somebody an apology for that. I never got an answer.
Yeah. Well, I guess in terms of the big picture of computing as it's evolved today, you know, Berry's contribution may not have seemed like, or, you know, his later developments and work didn't really fit into that picture, but as you point out, in the mass spec community, the work was a very important work, and it's just, you know, obviously the guy had a kind of a single focus in what was important. And,
this fellow, the author of this book, is apparently described somewhere as a historian of science, and one would think that he would recognize the existence of fields of science other than pure computing.
Yes, well, it's a difficult problem area, and I suppose that's why I'm interested in doing the kind of thing we're doing here, is to get people's input who were really there and who knew these individuals and had access to information that is not, you know, in books and in a lot of articles and because they're primary sources. So maybe we can do a little bit of that writing of Berry's slighting, as a result of this. It'll certainly be part of a historical resource which people can access in the future, and this bit of the past and his importance will be, you know, remembered. So we are pretty much to the point now where you've gotten familiar with the instrument. Obviously you've done quite a bit of research in mass spectrometry. When did you really start to do research work and tackle problems that were fundamental in nature? And
I think that must have been about 1951 or thereabouts. And by that time, well, in 1948, we moved from the original mass spec laboratory was in the, it was a large room with a small office adjacent to it, in a relatively small three-story red brick building in the middle of the refinery, with a railroad siding right outside our window, and every time a train moved on that siding, the whole building shook.
So did the mass spectrometer.
Also, the mass spec lab was the only room in the entire building that had air conditioning, and that was because the instrument demanded it. I also recall vividly that there were times when, even though it wasn't supposed to happen, somebody would turn off the air conditioning at night in order to save the electricity. And when that happened, then the big mercury vapor rectifier tubes that were used in a bridge rectifier circuit for our high voltage supply would all arc across, and in the morning everything was dead. When we started up again, it took us maybe 2 or 3 hours for everything to warm up again so we could actually operate and do useful work. And that was a source of real trouble. And somewhere along the line, somebody came along with a high vacuum rectifier tube that was far more compact than these mercury vapor tubes, but had the same basing arrangement. It carried far less current, but it carried all the current we needed. And that was an enormous improvement when we went to those high vacuum rectifier tubes.
Do you recall what the accelerating potential was for the instrument?
Well, the supply provided 4,000 volts.
Okay.
And I think that we actually started our scan at something like 3,800, if I remember rightly.
Okay, and this was a voltage scanning machine.
Oh, yes, yeah. It was a voltage scanning machine, mm-hmm. Very definitely.
Yeah.
In 1948, we moved into our new research laboratories on New York Avenue, about a mile from the refinery. We left part of the crew with the old machine in the old laboratory. They became the tech service laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And research was now in the new laboratory, and we got ourselves a 21-102 instrument, which we later modified, converted it to a 21-103.
Now, the first machine then, was that a
21-101?
101.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Does anybody know the history of that numbering? I know there's the 21 series of instruments, 21-101, 102, etc. I'm just curious if you had any concept of where it came from. I mean, obviously somebody came up with the number.
not really. I can't claim that.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I suspect it's pretty arbitrary.
Mm.
One of the nicest stories about that original machine, I hope this isn't a waste of time because I included that story in my reminiscences also, mm-hmm. was that we were very conscious that the homogeneity of the magnetic field was a lot less than one would have liked to have had.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation for that was that it was very hard to get a supply of the necessary iron during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the priorities that they might have had, the iron that went into that magnet came over the fence of a Navy shipyard in the dead of night. That was for real.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that vividly. That was a favorite story around our laboratory for years. And when I was putting together my reminiscences paper, I checked that with Harold Wiley,
mm-hmm.
and he confirmed that as absolutely correct, and he thought it was perfectly safe to say so in public at this stage.
How? I mean, you don't just go and throw a hunk of iron over the fence, though. I mean, there had to be a little bit of collaborative effort somehow to get that dude,
That's correct. In any case, that was stolen from a Navy shipyard, and it simply was the only way that they could get the iron they needed. There was, and you just did what you had to do. There wasn't any other way. It was exactly like a supply sergeant in the Army. How well your Army outfit functioned, how well you ate, how well, what sort of equipment you had was in very large part a function of how effectively your supply sergeant was as a scrounger.
Right.
and the same thing happened during the war here in the civilian economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Al mentions a similar thing where he was on the other side of that fence. He was evidently in charge of doling out or approving the use of, there was a particular, I guess, electrometer tube or some kind of electronic device that was, there were very few of, and they needed almost all of them in his work, and he had been put in charge of being the policeman for these things. So if anybody in the world wanted one of these, they had to get his approval for it, because there were so few, and they were needed for critical things. So it was something that we don't think of today as an issue because everything is there. But at that time, it must have been very difficult to do a lot of things simply because you couldn't get what you needed. I mean, it was available, but you weren't able to get it because you were in the wrong end of the business.
That's right. Well, in the new lab, gradually, the range of our work expanded considerably. I should say again that even before then, in the old lab, I remember as we started to introduce the analog computer,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know at exactly what stage the first digital computer came in. That was the card program calculator, IBM's CPC,
mm-hmm.
Whether we were still in the old lab or we'd moved by then. But I remember that we had a crew of, I think, originally 4 or 5 clerks who carried out all of our calculations. Subsequently, that clerical staff grew to a maximum of 7. These were people, generally high school graduates, who were reasonably comfortable with numbers. Some of them had taken a few courses at college level, but not very much. And we began to realize that they were slowing down.